Well, let's talk about you and how it all started. You're one of the few people I know who was actually born in California. Pasadena?
Pasadena, that's right. Yes. But I was born in Los Angeles Hospital, the California Lutheran Hospital. And I've said that I've been a radio buff as long as I can remember. Longer, actually. According to my mother, there was a table model Philco dragged into the California Lutheran Hospital by a nurse who hated to miss young Dr. Malone. So I was born then between the NBC chimes and a Rinso commercial, which makes me a Leo with Lever Brothers as my rising sign.
Yeah, I too was a product of radio. I'm not quite as old as you are, but almost. And so radio was extremely important. Do you remember the shows, your favorite shows as you were growing up?
Well, I love them all. I mean, it's like the kids that S.I. Hayakawa once called the electronic children. I mean, that's the yuppies, and that's and younger and a little bit older. That anybody that was born during the advent of television, they were born staring out through the bars of their crib at that glowing thing across the room. So those kids, and kids like my son who's 17, they'll watch a test pattern, you know, anything. That's what McLuhan meant when he said the medium is the message. With me, it was the same thing, except it's what, instead of my eyes, it was my ears perceiving this marvelous medium. And I would listen to anything that was on the radio practically, and I'd dial back and forth. My heroes were, of course, comedy heroes like Jack Benny and Fred Allen, and Fibber McGee and Molly, and Vic and Sade was a very strange show.
I missed that show. What was that?
Oh, God, Victor Gook, that was his name. It was very strange, kind of almost a Bob and Ray type of humor.
He took like that. Well, Sade, what do you hear from Mr. Gubbox, the garbage man? Anyhow, I don't know how that got on. It was so weird, but it was on for many years. Helped shape my kind of off-the-wall sense of humor. And then I loved Norman Corwin, who used to be, he is a veteran of CBS Radio. And Norman now is a friend of mine. And it's a great thing to have one of my heroes as a personal friend now. He had a wonderful book out a couple of years ago called Trivializing America. He's written about 23 books by now. Norman Corwin, he's about 70 now, I guess, and he's just as vital as ever. I'd love to do a show with him sometime.
Yeah, he's on my list of people I have to interview one of these days.
Well, he'll be happy to let you interview him. He mostly stays on the West Coast, and in fact, he and Ray Bradbury, who was a great mutual friend of Norman Corwin and myself, and the guy who played the son on Vic and Sade, his name is Billy Idelson. He played Rush Cook. And so we get together every 4 or 5 weeks and play old radio tapes and talk and schmooze and kid around. And the name of the group, Bradbury named it the Vic and Sadists of America. So anyhow, those were my main heroes. But I listened. I loved every, you know, Bergen and McCarthy and Joe Penner and everybody, I mean.
So at some point in your childhood, you wanted to be part of that world, huh?
Yes, and I at that point, growing up, this is a kid, 9, 10, 11 years old, I loved radio. It was, like my fraternal twin, I say in my book. I loved it as a listener, and it helped shape the way I looked at the world. But I never dreamed that I might end up on the other side of the grill cloth in my Atwater Kent radio and be performing. And how that happened, is this too long an answer to your question,
no,
sir?
No, it's not.
All right, just cut me off if it is. Fate transpired to put my uncle, who used to be a vaudeville magician, and of course vaudeville died, so now he was working as a security guard during World War II in CBS Radio in Hollywood. And he sat in the master control all night long. It's after Pearl Harbor. Somebody decided that the first thing that the Japanese would try to do is get in and disable the radio networks. They were probably right. So all night long, my uncle would sit nervously fingering his 38 Smith & Wesson, and appearing around the lobby. And every hour or so, he'd make his rounds. He'd go out and see if he could see any Asian people in the shrubbery, and then make his way through the studios, and periodically would find perfectly good Jack Benny scripts or scripts from Corman or something that was being done on the CBS network, and he'd bring these scripts home to me. So then I took these scripts and went out in the garage at night and after my homework, and I would play all the parts in the Jack Benny show and et cetera, et cetera. And my only audience was my rabbits and my guinea pigs out there. And I would say to the rabbits, I'm going to read this script for you guys, okay? And then I would say to my guinea pigs, I'm going to use you guys as sort of guinea pigs, okay? See how you like this. And after I would read a few pages, there was no applause in the garage theater, just the gentle crunching of lettuce leaves.
Well, that's kind of what I did, too, when I was a kid. I had my own radio station. I would have two turntables.
Your own radio station?
Yeah, in the living room I would have.
In the living room.
I'd bring my portable record player down, 78s. And,
yeah.
And on the other side.
Broadcasting on 2 watts?
Well, I didn't broadcast any further than my living room, but my father, Strongbird Carlson.
Strongbird Carlson.
That's right. I would be on one side and an old Philco phonograph on the other side, and I would take the 78s. I would type up a program log and copy commercials.
I would make commercials
out of the newspaper, and
that's terrific.
And have a phony microphone. And so I always thought this was good training. You know, one of these days I'd have my own radio station. Never happened, of course. I'm not sure I want to. But back to you.
Well, here you are, ending up like myself.
Ending up.
Ending up. No, and transitionally, you are. No. I'm not ending up anywhere yet. I mean, I plan to put in at least another 40 years. If not, how else? If I don't put in another 40 years, how can Willard Scott congratulate me then on the Today Show on my 102nd birthday?
Have you been on the Today Show?
I'm. Yes, I have.
But, this week?
This will be on the air in 3 weeks, right? So we have to. So I'm going on tomorrow morning. So that won't do. It's
no
good
right.
for
this
me.
This is all edited.
All edited. Yeah, I'm going on tomorrow morning with Brian Gumbel.
That's great. Has anybody watched the Today Show? Anybody who reads books? I mean,
good Lord, I hope so. No, I hear that it helps sell books.
I hear it.
And, sure. I mean, the thing is, these people have me on some treadmill here, you know, going from... They put me in about 4 cities every 2 days. Nice, easy schedule like that.
It's kind of fun, though, isn't it?
Well, I'll let you know from my hospital bed after it's all over, Don.
Well, what happened after high school?
What are you going to do, a radio special here out of this thing? I mean, these evoke long answers out of me. I try to keep them terse and short.
Well,
How long is the show?
The show's about 2 minutes, but it runs in a series. It runs in a series. So in New York, it runs about, it runs 15 times a week in New York.
Have we ever mentioned the book?
Actually, what I'm doing is kind of taking you through the book.
Yes, okay.
So, you know, your comments all are linked to your book, and because you describe your uncle, the magician, and the rabbits, and all of that in the book, and your career in the army, and your voices at Warner Brothers, and so forth. So I was kind of taking you through a little bit of that.
Good. Well, I wrote this book because I'd been promising myself and other people like Ray Bradbury that I would finally get some of this stuff down for years. And then finally, an editor at Times Books, the company that was owned by the New York Times, and then it now is owned by Random House. But this editor, Jonathan Siegel, persisted and was, you know, wore me down finally until I finally did the book. And he's the editor-in-chief that edited my book. And I said, why do you want me to do a memoir? And he said, I don't know, I thought maybe you could do kind of a funny Iacocca. So that's what it is. Anyhow, after high school, I thought, I'll just duck into Hollywood here and see if I can get a job, you know. And my mother said, Stanley, you just don't step off the bus and get a job, you know. And so my father said, yeah, there's a lot of strange, bad characters in Hollywood. Be careful. And my mother packed me a sandwich. And I got on the Asbury Rapid Transit System bus and went into Hollywood. Finally, I said to the bus driver, Where's the middle of Hollywood? He looks at me kind of weirdly. You know, where do you want to get off, kid? I says, is this the middle of Hollywood? He says, this is as middle as it gets. Slammed on the brakes. I got off the bus. Went into a building, strange old building. There was a talent agent in that building. I said, my God, a real talent agent, you know. So I went up to this talent agent. And this woman, who I'd never seen before, is called Stars of Tomorrow. That's the name of the agency. I started auditioning for her in the lobby of her office, you know. She said, hold it right there, she said. And she puts her hand around me, and now she closes her eyes, looks up, and said, let's all pray. She held the hands of another agent. You know, we all linked hands. She said, dear Lord, please help this young man stand, what was your last name again? Freeberg, I said, straightening it out for the Lord. Help him to get work in the entertainment business in some way. In Jesus' name, amen. That's, I swear, this is what happened. Now, she clapped her hands briskly and said to me, have you ever thought about doing cartoon voices? There's radio, of course, but what about cartoons? Never crossed my mind. Picks up the phone, calls Warner Brothers Cartoons, gets me an interview the next afternoon. Next afternoon, I'm there, and this man, John Burton was his name. He was the man that ran Warner's Cartoons for Leon Schlesinger. Takes me in through all these desks where thousands and thousands of cells are being painted of Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and so forth. And now he takes me into this room, and I hear the little theater filling up there, and I'm behind a curtain, and all these directors are coming into the room, see? Finally, I did all these voices, everything I had ever conceived of doing, imitations, a lot of original voices, including the voice of FDR. All right, now there's applause, and I'm led out, and these three directors came out instantly. One of them was Bob Clampett, who told me he had just finished a cartoon with a small Scotty dog, just like Fala, the dog that FDR had. And he decided, as he was listening to me, to have the dog talk like FDR. So he said, can you record the day after tomorrow? I said, oh, I think I could work it in, you know. Another man came up, Chuck Jones, who created the Coyote and the Roadrunner and many other things. One of the fathers of Bugs Bunny. He said he'd try to use me in some way, and he did many times. And then another man named Friz Freleng came up, who would later create the Pink Panther series. And he said to me, why haven't we heard of you before, Stan? And I said, I was just barely 18. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I've been around, you know. He said, oh, I didn't mean that the way it sounded. I mean, I'm sure you didn't just get off the bus.
You had kind of a checkered career in the military, didn't you?
Oh yeah, I hoped that I would get into special services right away, which is the entertainment division. And when I was shipped to Fort MacArthur, California, the first thing I did is go in to see the captain on the base, and I showed him all these letters of recommendation for Warner's Cartoons and CBS Radio and so forth. Although I hadn't yet had my own show on CBS. But I had worked as a radio actor on CBS shows, Destination Tomorrow with Chet Huntley and other things. So, anyhow, he looks at the letters and says, gee, this is terrific. You're just the guy we've been looking for. You know, I'm told to report to a certain building there. Now, on the way to the building, I stop and get my Eleanor Roosevelt hat, my false teeth, and funny props, you know, and Jimmy Durante knows. Now, I show up in this building, and I thought, what is that strange smell? It was bread. It was bread that I smelled. Guy says, are you Freeberg? I says, yeah. He says, okay, I figured your head size to be about 7 3/8. He gives me a baker's hat. He said, do you ever bake bread before? I said, no. He said, well, you're a baker now. Right? That's it. He says, what's this stuff under your arm? Well, I said, oh, it's kind of a Jimmy Durante nose and a couple Eleanor Roosevelt teeth. He says to me, that ain't going to help you bake bread.
That was good training, though. Good training for radio.
Baking bread? Yeah, just what I needed. It was perfect. It was all people in radio should bake bread for a while. I learned how to make an omelet for 2,000 men.
Despite your love for radio and your early work in radio, you also became an early television performer. Tell me about that.
Well, I really, this is a chapter in my book called Are You Sure This Is the Ground Floor of Television? This is about late 1949. This man Clampett, once again, had left Warner's Cartoons now, and it started. He had an idea, rough idea for a show called, which later was called Beanie and Cecil. In the beginning, it was called Time for Beanie. And he had another wonderful actor whom I'd never met before. His name was Dawes Butler. And so Dawes and I thought we were hired to write this show and do the voices and so forth. And so instead of being writer-actors, it turns out the man had in mind we would be writer-actor-puppeteers, and we'd never done puppets before in our life. We said, "Where are the puppeteers?" He said, Clampett said, "You're the puppeteers." So I told Butler, I said, "I think this is called on-the-job training, you know." 3 days later in Clampett's garage, a man walked in named Klaus Landsberg, who later was the one who photographed the first atom blast from Yucca Flats and so forth, a terrific pioneer in television. He, after all the networks had turned this show down, he said, "Terrific." He had a German accent. "Yeah, this is Friday. Could you start Monday?" So that was it. Monday, we're on the air holding the puppets up. And the show went for 5 years. Dawes and I, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, we did Time for Beanie.
And these were the days when there was no videotape.
No videotape, but we had kinescope, which was pretty crappy quality, but it's all we had, you know. And
but your show was live.
Show was live every night. What, are you kidding? I mean, you know, if you made a mistake or the set fell in and you had to ad lib and make a joke out of it. You know, one time all the cue cards fell on the floor, and so we had to ad lib the show. So just, you know, to keep things going, because we couldn't remember really what the show was about, I, with my arms up in the air and the camera shooting over our head, I had Cecil the Sea Serpent slam through a cardboard wall. And when he came back in, and the crew is laughing, you know, came back in, I noticed up on the monitor that his one nostril had fallen off. So he said, "I've gained a laugh and lost a nostril." And Dawes ad-libbed. He said, "Don't worry about it, Cease. We'll just have to go down and make a withdrawal at the nostril bank." Anyhow, he said, "Good night, folks." Clampett came roaring around the set because he was in the booth. He didn't know what happened. He says, boys, please stick to this script. Anyhow, we were delighted to find out that not, and along with the millions of other people that watched that show, Albert Einstein actually, in the last days of his life, was a fan of Time for Beanie.
You probably learned something from it as well.
We hope we taught Dr. Einstein a few things, yes.
You were one of the last network performers in the late 1950s on CBS, no less.
Yes, I was the last network radio comedian. Big deal, you know, but I mean, that's it. When I replaced Jack Benny in 1957, that was the last of the line. And after 17 weeks sustaining, because they couldn't, all the sponsors had pulled out for television at that point. That show went off, and after I went off, they disbanded the studio orchestra, and there were no more shows emanating on any commercial radio network from Los Angeles or New York. So that was it.
Yeah, there's nothing left. Well, we still have a radio network, but it's hourly newscasts and a couple of features here and there. A lot of our programs, such as my own, are syndicated through the CBS radio station's news syndication service.
Yeah.
It's easier to sell them that way because the affiliates don't take the programming. They just don't do it. But you,
a man who was at CBS, not there anymore, talked to me periodically. He was in New York about doing another Freeberg show. This is early in this decade, I mean, in the 80s. He talked about doing another Freeberg show, just like we did originally, but, you know, for the 80s or 90s. But, I don't know, he could never get the clearance or the money or whatever. And then he talked to me about doing small shows like you do.
Yeah, I've got to say that the new Stan Freeberg show would have to run 2 minutes.
2 minutes, that's right. Well, we couldn't have afford Billy May in the orchestra, but I could bring in a Jew's harp or something.
That's right. I guess it's the attention span of the audience. They can't listen for longer than 2 minutes to any one topic. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's about books. But it took a certain degree of courage for CBS to run the Stan Freeberg show in the 50s, and yet you had some problems with CBS at the same time, didn't you?
The only problems I ever had were with the standards and practices people, or continuity acceptance people. You know, I never did anything that was off color. That's not my style. You know, I don't do that. But they had trouble with worrying about groups of people that they thought I might offend or institutions or what have you. They were just made nervous. You know, I, for example, on the opening show, if I hadn't done this, the people at CBS would have napped through my show and not paid the slightest bit of attention to me, you know. But because I did this, everything was on red alert after that, you know. Watch Freeburg. Freeburg is coming on, you know. What I did is, it seems mild now, I did an attack on the city of Las Vegas. You know, that's a big deal, jeez. I had two hotels, the El Sodom and the Rancho Gomorrah. Some of my biblical background, being raised as a preacher's kid, you know. But anyhow,
of course, it was pretty sexy. You're talking about the Gaza Strip.
Pretty sexy, you know. In the original show, they didn't want me to kid the Gaza Strip. I had the one of these lavish hotels, cutting the Gaza Strip into parts and numbering the parts the way William Randolph Hearst used to move great art treasures to San Simeon. Then they flew, in my fable, they flew the pieces of the Gaza Strip to Las Vegas to be reassembled in the proper order in the new Suez Room. Anyhow, instead of the Gaza Strip, they made me change it to an international incident. You love that? But when it came time to put out the Capitol album of the best of the Stan Freeberg shows, I just put the tape back together the way it was when I originally did it, back with the Gaza Strip and with the hydrogen bomb on the end. My God, you know, they said, don't mention the hydrogen bomb, CBS said to me. I said, well, what's the problem? You think if we don't mention it, it may go away? You know. But anyhow, one of the hotels, of course, booked as a lavish spectacle. They booked the hydrogen bomb for one night only, and that was the end of the city. I called the city Los Feroces, which in Spanish translates roughly to the greedy ones.
We were such innocents back in the 40s and 50s. You became a big recording star back during that period. What was your first big record?
Yeah, well, actually, by the time I did the Stan Freeberg show on the CBS radio network, I was already a recording star. I started about 6-7 years earlier on Capitol with John and Marcia. And John, Marcia, that was the first big hit. And then I satirized everything in sight. The pop music field. They did, you know, Harry Belafonte's Banana Boat song. And
one of your more controversial records was, I think it was called Green Christmas.
Yeah, that was probably the most controversial. And there was an attack on the over-commercialization of Christmas. And so anyhow, I heard it this last Christmas. Dick Cavett had a Christmas radio special he did. I don't know if it was on CBS or not.
And they're still playing it.
He played it, yeah.
Well, I think...
Can I tell you something?
Sure.
Here's a really interesting thing. At the end of Dick Cavett's playing of Green Christmas, a guy came out with a disclaimer and said the opinions expressed in the preceding recording do not reflect the opinions of this station or this network. After all these years.
Yeah, that was something they would say back in the 50s.
But they just said that in 1989, I mean, when Dick Cavett played this.
Yeah, so it's as though they had that disclaimer on a disc from the 1950s and just ran it with your record.
Possibly. But it was nice to know that I was after all these years, I was still able to strike a nerve, doctor, you know.
Yeah. Well, you moved into the advertising game. How did that come about?
Well, I had always... hoped that if anybody ever asked me to do a commercial, I would be able to do it in the way that I hoped and wished that somebody had done it for me, because I was, you know, disgusted and irritated like everybody else with most advertising. It was a really hard sell era in the 50s, you know. And buy some today, say mother, that was the kind of approach. And nobody ever heard of using humor in advertising at that point. So this man in San Francisco had a client that was in trouble, Contadina Tomato Paste. He was with Cunningham and Walsh, and the giant Hunt's company had come in and buried this little tomato paste company. So he knew that he liked the way I used the medium of sound as a record and radio comedian, and he was looking for somebody to create radio commercials for the ear, and he thought humor might work, and he came to me. I did these commercials, and I created a line, who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can also. Anyhow, within 3 months after my stuff going on the air, Hunt's had cut their price, and 6 months later they were giving 2 cases away with every 10 in an effort to catch up. So it was David and Goliath, you know, this little tomato paste company fighting the giant Punch Company, and eventually they were swallowed up by Carnation. That's what the syndrome, that's what happens. I help little companies to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Then they become an interesting enough company to be absorbed by a giant conglomerate. It's happened over and over. The Chun King Company was absorbed by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, your commercials made it fun to listen to a spot. You know, usually it's something you just listen to get through, but you did a number of others. But you, at the same time, you had to fight the gray suits in these advertising agencies, didn't you?
Oh yeah, there was always that, yeah. The Contadina stuff, originally nobody liked it except the president of the Contadina Tomato Paste Company. And they couldn't understand how humor could possibly sell anything because it sounded too much like entertainment. But my theory is that if we have to live with advertising, why don't you make some part of it bearable at least, you know. We're not selling the Holy Grail here, you know. It's just a box of prunes or a can of tomato paste.
You have a hilarious episode in the book about your relationship with David Merrick. Can you just kind of give me a synopsis?
No, it's difficult to synopsize anything that painful and that went on for that many years. But anyway, now that I've written it down, my decade or so with David Merrick, it's sort of been exercised out of my psyche now. I feel better now having written that. Ray Bradbury, my friend, beat me over the head and said, "You got to put this in a book." And Norman Corwin said, "Please include the Merrick part of your life." So I did. That's why there were no more albums of the United States of America, because David Merrick wanted to produce it on Broadway, and he loved the first album. I must say the man had impeccable taste. Got to give him that. And he said, "Don't record any more volumes because it'll take the edge off the Broadway show that we're going to do." So anyhow, you know, many years later, I still hadn't done the second album, which is all already written. And finally, the end came when David Merrick came to me at the St. James Theater in New York where we were rehearsing and said, "Stan," I said, "Yes." He said, "Take Lincoln out of the Civil War. He doesn't work." You know, I said, "Ah, oh, geez, David, you can't pull Lincoln out of the Civil War. I mean, people will notice." He said, no apologia, just take him out." So I thought, I'm dealing with a lunatic here, you know. And my wife pulled me out. She said, "This is never going to work. Because supposing this show gets on and you don't have a heart attack from dealing with Mr. Merrick and you don't have a bleeding ulcer, what good will it be? Because it will not be the way you saw it in your head." So that's why I pulled away. So I swear to you, Don, in the next year, the United States of America will be either a Broadway show or will go into pre-production into a movie.
Well, you have some hilarious stories in your book, and yet you only go up to, I believe, about the mid-1960s. Why stop at that point?
Well, I wanted people to be able to read and lift the book easily. And, Winston Churchill took six volumes just to get his memoirs of World War II alone down. And I didn't want to make something as heavy as the Random House Encyclopedia.
Well, has anything happened to you since the mid-1960s?
No, I took a nap, actually. I took a nap. I just woke up now as you walked in with the mic. Get out of here. Jeez, some of the more controversial things that's happened to me around advertising, not the least of which was Prince the rock star threatening to sue me 2 years ago, and the Prince Spaghetti Company. He thought my commercial was a little too close to a Prince concert. And his lawyers actually wrote Prince and asked them to cease and desist using their client's name on their spaghetti box. And they only had the name since 1912, you know.
That's right. Besides, Prince is not Prince's name anyway. It was the name of your dog when you were a kid.
That's right. Come here, Prince. Attaboy. So a lot of those things will be in this book and many other things.
Volume 2.
Volume 2, yes. People won't have to wait as long for Volume 2 of the book as they did for the record because, for one thing, David Merrick has not come around asking to turn my memoirs into a musical. And I have a trap door all set by my front door if he should walk up, and we have a button. My daughter and my son, already they've been trained to push the button if a man with a large black mustache appears in the doorway.
Well, I want to tell you that when you go on the Today Show tomorrow, you're not going to be allowed to talk about your book. You understand that you're going to talk about the electronic media and advertising and this sort of thing. So
no kidding. Yeah. I didn't realize that.
I have to warn you.
Yeah.
Don't even take a copy of it. They won't even pan it. But fortunately for you, my little show is all about books, and so that's what I wanted to cover with you. And of course, I've been a fan of yours since my youth, and still am. And I thought it was.
Now you're a very old man. And how old do you think that makes me? I feel very old with your having.
Well, you were a prodigy. So you started.
That's right. Yes, I was the funny Andre Previn. I started very, very young as a prodigy. And I was actually working when I was just barely 18, started in radio. And my son now is a kind of a prodigy. His name is Donovan Freeberg. And he can be seen now in an Encyclopedia Britannica commercial sitting in front of a computer, kidding around about the... He says, I suppose you're going to pop one of those 800 numbers on me. And I said, yeah, we thought we might. And it pops on his chest. He looks down and says, and there it is. Okay. Anyhow, that kid, Donovan Freeberg, when he was 8 and 9, was the voice of Charlie Brown, one of the many voices of Charlie Brown for Bill Melendez. So he's been working around a long time. And he also was in a recent commercial I did for the National Association of Broadcasters, and he and I are walking around inside my head. Do you think you can get a copy of that? It starts off with footsteps, and I say, I'm just sort of walking around here inside the theater of my mind. And then my son says, how did I get in here? And I say, I put you in here. That's the great thing about radio. You can put anything you want in here. And then we hear such sound effects as a pterodactyl taking a bite out of the Superdome. I think you're going to have to play this.
Stan Freeberg, thank you very much.